Thanks for joining with us today for Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith.
And I'm Tenery Taylor. Environmental historian Sam White of The Ohio State University has written that the European settlers who came to the Americas in the 1600s may have picked one of the worst centuries to do so. Professor White is the author of A Cold Welcome, The Little Ice Age and Europe's Encounter with North America, and he joins us now. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you for having me.
As a historian, why research natural disasters?
So there are really two ways of looking at this. One is because natural disasters, including those related to climate, have played an underappreciated role throughout history. We have to consider that even when these changes were smaller than the changes that we're currently experiencing with global warming, that people through most of the past were more vulnerable. These were, for the most part, people in the pre-industrial world who depended on the stability of the seasons from year to year for the success of agriculture, for the stability of food prices. Another important reason, though, is because we are interested in climate change today, and whatever insights we can gain from the past are certainly worth looking into.
Do you find yourself in a lonely place as a historian trying to argue that the climate is really important and integral to studying history?
Less and less so. When this first interested me as a graduate student, so going back about 15 years ago as I began to write my first book, then there certainly was a lot of opposition and a lot of just sheer confusion. A lot of historians had I think it's fair to say, knee-jerk reaction that if you raise something like climate or other major environmental factors, that was a kind of simplistic determinism compared to the cultural history that was then more in vogue. Since then, I think we've seen what one historian has even called a material turn in history, a greater appreciation for the role of environmental and material factors again. And this is, of course, driven by our own current anxiety about the influence of climate change and climate disasters.
Let's go back to the Little Ice Age. How was this more than just a bad winter? Describe it for us.
So the Little Ice Age is a rather complicated term. It actually goes back to the work of glaciologists who were trying to compare periods of small advances in glaciers that came in between the Great Ice Ages. So to take a step back even farther, for the last couple million years since the Pleistocene, we have had periodic ice ages interrupted by shorter interglacial periods. So we are living in one of those interglacial periods now, the Holocene. But even within interglacial periods, there are colder periods, and over the very long term, these are driven by slight fluctuations in the Earth's orbit. Now, the Little Ice Age was then adopted by climatologists to refer to a general period of cooling whose periodization wasn't entirely clear. By some standards, it began by the late 1200s, by others, only in the 1500s, and certainly ended sometime by the middle 19th century. So it's not entirely clear in most uses what Little Ice Age means. Now, I take the Little Ice Age here in this book to refer particularly to the period of coldest temperatures, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, but probably globally as well, between the late 1500s and the beginning of the 18th century. And this period was cooler for a number of reasons, but chiefly because of a number of very cold decades following large tropical volcanic eruptions. Those cast dust and aerosols high in the stratosphere, which blocked in incoming sunlight, which slightly cooled the Earth and also, in some cases, wreaked havoc with the usual atmospheric patterns of circulation.
Well, farmers would see their crops affected by that, definitely, if temperatures plummet, right?
Yes, certainly. This was the main direct impact that the Little Ice Age would have on people's lives and livelihoods.
And was it as serious a problem in the New World as in the Old World?
Yes, certainly. And I think this is a relatively recent discovery from climatology. If you were to go back, you know, decades before, most of the evidence was coming from Europe. And so very often the Little Ice Age was cast as a primarily European phenomenon. What we've learned, thanks to the work of both paleoclimatologists, those who work with physical records, as well as historical climatologists who work with written records to reconstruct past climates, is that the Little Ice Age was probably a global phenomenon, certainly across the Northern Hemisphere. And parts of North America underwent just as much disruption to their climates, especially during these periods of volcanic cooling, as did Europe.
But this is an age of exploration, and so you've got people on the move coming from Europe to North America. Did they expect did they get what they expected, I guess, as far as climate was concerned? If they were having really cold winters in Europe, did they think they were going to run into the same thing in the Americas, or were they surprised?
So there are two issues to consider here. One is that even in Europe, Europeans didn't necessarily realize they were living through a little ice age. That is to say that they didn't have an appreciation that there was a long-term cooling trend or that there were these particularly cold decades following volcanic eruptions. Rather, what they experienced was an increasing frequency and severity of extreme weather. And they didn't necessarily know when this was going to end. And very often they interpreted it in terms that of, you know, divine punishment even. You know, that God was punishing them for their sins by sending this extreme weather, or at least that's the way they often wrote about it. There were a few observers, particularly careful observers, since some people started to keep weather diaries and records of observations of natural phenomenon by the late 16th century. And they did actually notice that by the end of their life, it was cooler, objectively speaking, than it had been when they were children. However, most people didn't really understand at the time they were living in a little ice age, which certainly sets it apart from the global warming we're undergoing now. So this is one element then of confusion. They couldn't know that they were living in a little ice age and therefore to expect it in America. But there's another element of confusion that is even greater. And this was identified by past historians, particularly in the work of NYU historian Karen Kupperman. And she referred to this as the puzzle of American climates. That is, Europeans expected that climates around the world would be more or less the same on the same latitudes. In fact, the word climate didn't really have the meaning that it does now as being the average weather. Climate meant something more like latitude. And therefore, when they got to the Americas, they were really expecting the same lands on the same latitudes to have the same climates. But this was not the case at all. If you take a map of the Atlantic, I think most people would really be surprised to see how much farther north most of Europe is than most of the more thickly inhabited parts of North America. So New York City is closer to the latitude of Rome. Virginia is close to the latitude of Sicily, the Carolinas to Morocco. And this is the expectation that European explorers brought when they crossed over the Atlantic. So it was often a great disappointment and great confusion to them to find that America has much stronger continental seasons, including colder winters.
So New York is not going to feel like Rome. And so that was a little bit of a surprise to them.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So even though, you know, the parts of Europe can't have cold weather, they don't really typically see the same degree of variability and seasonality that we see in America. And so America certainly can't grow the same kind of crops, including its inability to grow Mediterranean crops at the same latitudes as the Mediterranean.
Right. Now, you start your book with a tale of the Vikings, which goes, this is several hundred years before these European colonists coming to North America. Tell us about their early colonial efforts in the New World.
Well, I don't actually begin with the Vikings themselves. What I found was something, to me, stranger and more fascinating than that, and that is that the Danish kings at the turn of the 17th century, were actually going out to look for old Viking colonies in Greenland.
Right,
they expected
right.
them still to be there.
Mm-hmm.
They sent out three expeditions, and all of these, of course, encountered freezing temperatures, heavy sea ice that often prevented them from even reaching the coast of Greenland. And when they did reach it, of course, the Inuit, who had moved into areas that once inhabited by these Viking settlements. So it was really a way of looking at both the challenges of trying to reach America during the 17th century, as opposed to the slightly warmer period when the Vikings first arrived, as well as the confusion that confronted Europeans as they tried to make sense of this new continent.
Because they were trying to get to where they thought these settlements were, and there was so much ice built up, they couldn't even get there. Am I understanding that right?
Yes, in some cases. They did... one of these expeditions did actually manage to land on a couple points in western Greenland, but the other two really couldn't. The third just really couldn't approach the Greenland coast at all. And I've been doing some work recently as part of collaborative work with climatologists to try to see how many expeditions really encountered impassable sea ice in many of these waters. And there does seem to be a period in which this is much worse during the late 1500s and early 1600s. Largely connected, it seems, to cooling generated by these large volcanic eruptions.
So They don't ever find the people that they're looking for. What do you think? What do we think happened to the Viking settlements? When were they established? The Viking settlements in the New World.
So this is really well outside of my regular field of expertise, but this goes back to the Middle Ages, during a period sometimes referred to as the medieval warm period, although that's slightly a misnomer. Nevertheless, it was a period of slightly average warmer temperatures across the North Atlantic, not necessarily in other parts of the world, and slightly less sea ice than there would be in the Little Ice Age. And these settlements had probably disappeared by the mid-15th century. We don't know the exact circumstances. It certainly occurred around the time that temperatures were falling and sea ice was becoming worse. Waters were also becoming more stormy. And of course, the impacts of the Black Death in Europe also meant that some of the economic lifeline to Greenland, its role in trade in Europe, had diminished too, making it less of a inviting prospect. We don't know whether people left voluntarily or whether the last settlers there starved or whether they were overrun by the Inuit, but they simply disappear from the historical record.
Well, let's get into some of the colonies that did make a go of it. And let's start with Jamestown. This is a story we all think we know about this, but how does looking at climate change change our understanding of the success of Jamestown?
So it was discovered some time ago. This is not an original discovery of this book, that tree ring records of Eastern North America reveal that the Jamestown colony happened to coincide with one of the worst droughts in that region, in that part of Virginia, probably for the past 700 years. So that basic information was known. What I tried to do in Cold Welcome was both to put that in the broader perspective of confusion about climate and other challenges of colonization in the New World, and to go very carefully through both the climatological record, which extends beyond these tree rings, as well as the written record to see just how that drought could have affected the settlement. And it probably did in a number of ways. It certainly made it harder for the English themselves to grow crops. But more significant than that, there are a number of indications in the written and physical record that the local Native Americans were also suffering from shortages of corn in particular. And on top of that, the freezing weather may have also made it more difficult to dig up tubers, wild tubers, which were often a food that was a fallback when corn didn't work out. So in these ways, it made the local Powhatan Confederacy, the major Indian chiefdom in the region, much less willing to trade for food, much more willing, of course, to resist, including resist violently when the English tried to steal food, and almost certainly contributed to the major problems that the settlement had, which led to the death of most of the early colonists.
Tell us about the starving time of 1610.
So in this year, a number of factors came together. The colony was, at that point, in more or less open warfare with the Powhatan Confederacy. The settlers were cut off, trapped in their fort. They had run out of most of their food because a new group of colonists that had been sent to relieve them had largely been scattered in a hurricane. Some of them ended up in Bermuda, including the flagship, which then later arrived in new ships, and the others arriving separately, lacking leadership, basically picking fights with local Native American villages. So they were already in desperate circumstances. But added to that, the drought persisted, the severe winter persisted, which made it much harder to raise food or to find wild foods. And it could be the case, too, that it actually made the James River at that point more salty than usual, which both made it more dangerous to drink from, but may have actually interrupted the run of sturgeon, which were usually a major source of food for the colony.
How does that happen? How does a river get more salty?
Because you have, this is already in kind of a tidewater region. So the characteristics of the water, whether it becomes more fresh or more brackish, is a balance between the water flowing in from inland and the sea encroaching. So if you have much less fresh water flowing out, then you're going to get more encroachment of seawater in, which then makes the water more brackish.
Why didn't they just give up?
So the Jamestown colonists actually were about to give up. Once the intended leaders of the colony, who had wrecked on Bermuda, did arrive, their first reaction was to abandon the colony altogether. And actually, the one best surviving account of that episode says that, you know, when that announcement was made, everybody cheered, which gives you a sense of, you know, the misery they had experienced. And of course, we're now only talking about a relative handful of survivors compared to the number who had originally colonized. So their plan was to go down to the mouth of the James River to join up with another outpost they'd set up there, which actually had survived much, much better than the settlers at Jamestown. And it's unclear exactly what was intended at that point. We have different conflicting accounts that are actually impossible to reconcile. But my best interpretation of trying to reconcile these and trying and working from the assumption of who knew what and when and what their interests were in writing these accounts is that they were probably going to try to make their way, wait a few days at that colony, refresh themselves, maybe make their way either to someplace like Newfoundland, where they might be able to refresh themselves with the fishing colony set up there, and then turn back to England. So I do believe that the balance of evidence is they were about to abandon the colony when, just by astounding coincidence, the new relief ships do arrive from England, another relief expedition, probably saving the colony in the nick of time by a matter of days.
We need to take a quick break here on Constant Wonder. We've been speaking with Sam White. He's an associate professor of environmental history at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of A Cold Welcome, The Little Ice Age and Europe's Encounter with North America. When we come back, we'll learn about other new world challenges. Scurvy in Canada and snowstorms in Arkansas and Alabama? Stay with us. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenere Taylor, and we have with us Sam White. He's the author of A Cold Welcome, The Little Ice Age and Europe's Encounter with North America. Now, compared to the English efforts at Jamestown, did the French have any greater success in their settlements?
Absolutely not. So the French have just as bad a time of it as the English do, both because of this basic confusion about the climates of the New World, as well as because of the particular weather that they encounter, which was often particularly extreme and unfortunate.
Well, let's talk about St. Croix. What happened there?
So St. Croix was an early effort of the French to try to settle in New England. They explored options in New England and Nova Scotia before eventually settling in Quebec, making that their first permanent colony in 1608. St. Croix is what we now call Dotchet Island. It's a small island actually between Maine and New Brunswick, so essentially on the U.S.-Canadian border. And nowadays, you can approach it from either side. So you can try to drive down from New Brunswick or up to that little tip of Maine there and look out at the island, which is actually a nature preserve. But this was a small island, which looked like a good prospect for a settlement. It looked safe. They were always worried about attack from local Native Americans, even though they turned out to have quite good relations with them in this case. And it looks like an inviting place to stay. However, they simply didn't reckon on the winters that they would encounter there. By their reckoning, this being northern Maine, didn't actually make it cold. If you actually look on a map again, Maine, the state of Maine, is roughly around central France in terms of its latitude. Paris is actually just slightly north of Quebec City, which is remarkable, again, when you think about the difference in their climates. So you have to put your perspective in theirs then and think about the climate they were expecting, something like central France. Instead, what they got was a really terrible winter, even by the standards of that part of the world. We know from fairly detailed descriptions that Samuel Champlain and another colonist left during that expedition, that the winter started very early, heavy frosts and hard freezes by October, stretching well into April before things even began to thaw. And this led to a terrible outbreak of scurvy. It's not something we necessarily associate with climate. We tend to think of scurvy as being associated with long ship voyages. Mm-hmm. But long, hard frosts, long, hard winters could accomplish the same thing because sailors didn't yet know to bring anything that contained vitamin C to prevent scurvy at the time. And if they couldn't get out, if they couldn't get fresh food of any kind, they would suffer from scurvy in these colonies during the winter, just as they would on a long ship voyage. So scurvy debilitates almost the entire colony. Only a few people are still healthy, and it kills a very large percentage of the colony in just a horrible way, which was very carefully described by settlers at the time. So we're quite sure of what it was.
Did they have food stored up And did it store well?
It would be things like ship's biscuit, salt meat. They had some wine, which the strongest wine managed to stay liquid, but mostly they had cider, hard cider, which froze solid, which gives you a sense of how cold this was. Their food was abundant enough, and it kept, of course, because it was frozen. So in that sense, they did much better than most English and Spanish expeditions did. But because none of it was something that contained vitamin C, and because they weren't getting any fresh food, they died all the same, but of scurvy instead of starvation.
Well, let's go to the American South, to Santa Fe. And here we've got Spanish settlers. So we've visited with the English and the French, and let's see how the Spanish do. What were their efforts like?
So the Spanish efforts, this is really quite interesting because, of course, Spain had a claim to all of North America in the early 16th century. We're really going back to the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494. Although the French and English never really wanted to accept that, the Spanish Empire, particularly as part of the larger Habsburg Empire, really was the dominant power in Europe throughout most of the 1500s, and it was able to keep British and French sailors out and colonists out. And this is actually one of the reasons why you start to get the English colonies coming in the 1590s and then the first decade of the 17th century. That was actually the first chance they really had to challenge Spanish power, because Spain itself was greatly weakened during that decade by natural disasters at home and by impending bankruptcy, essentially. Spain could just simply no longer support its imperial commitments with a declining revenue that was being hit by shortages and famines in Castile. So to go back to the Spanish efforts then, they had quite a head start, if you will, but there were simply numerous expeditions, both to the southeast and to the southwest, all of which go badly wrong for one reason or another. A lot of this has to do, again, with geographical confusion. They simply did not know the shape of the continent and oftentimes where they were. What we might call anthropological confusion. They did not know what kinds of people and what kinds of polities, you could say, to expect. They were expecting either to find what they found in, say, the Aztec Empire or the Inca Empire, large centralized states they might conquer, or else sort of people who they saw as being simply scattered and nomads like they might have encountered traveling up northwestern Mexico. Instead, what they encountered were sort of medium-sized chiefdoms, which could put up quite a fight compared to these small Spanish expeditions, mm-hmm. but didn't offer any kind of clear central political hierarchy over a large area that they could conquer. So in some ways, it was the worst of both worlds. But an added factor, which I, of course, emphasize in this book, is the extreme climate they often encountered. In the early 1540s, it seems, there was a widespread freezing winters. And this is something encountered in expeditions that went along the California coast into the southwest, and, of course, the Soto expedition in the southeast, what the Spanish then called La Florida.
So this is in the south where we don't usually see freezing winters, and they're getting freezing winters, which is totally unexpected and probably unexpected from our point of view, too, knowing the modern climate there.
Yes, it's important to note, though, that this is not something totally unheard of in modern times. There are occasionally, you know, Arctic outbreaks, which we now associate with the weakening of the polar vortex, which can actually bring these freezing temperatures into the south. This is something that you can still see in weather records throughout the 1800s as well. It's really, this is not just because this is the Little Ice Age, but it's also because we are now and have been for more than a century experiencing global warming. Mm. And so we simply forget that this was a feature, a rare, admittedly, but a feature of the climate, sometimes in the American South. It's possible, although we don't have the records to say, that maybe these kinds of polar outbreaks and freezing winters were more common during the Little Ice Age, during the 16th century, perhaps. But it's not clear. I think that the major difference to emphasize here is the difference between our present day perspective of global warming and the way things had been prior to that.
Were the Spanish ever going to succeed in New Mexico and in the American South?
Yes and no. On the one hand, they were not going to succeed in the way that they expected. The early expeditions were really in search of peoples and empires to conquer. It was really people that they wanted more so than land or particular resources. They imagined sort of capturing a large subject population they could use to pay tribute. That idea begins to change over the course of the 16th century. I would say by the time we have the Oñate expedition into New Mexico in 1598, that now they're actually looking for mineral wealth. They're looking for gold and silver. It's sort of a part of a larger silver rush, if you will, that had been already going on in Mexico as that became the dominant silver producer in the New World. So by that standard, maybe they could have succeeded if they had had more success in finding mineral wealth and in inviting the people and the infrastructure needed to export it. I would also stress that they might have been able to establish permanent colonies had it not been for these accidents of climate. The weather they encountered, even by the standards of the Little Ice Age, was probably just incredibly unlucky. And it didn't just end with these freezing winters. There was an even larger expedition under the leadership of Tristan de Luna. This is one that's almost forgotten in American history. It was actually one of the largest expeditions to North America until well into the 1600s. And it failed not so much because of these cold winters, although that was a factor, but because as soon as it landed in present-day Mobile Bay, the supplies were simply kept on ships with the assumption that the bay was safe enough to prevent any storm from damaging those ships. But they get hit by a hurricane almost immediately. I mean, just out of the blue. Mm. And part of the problem was that, of course, they just did not understand hurricanes and tropical storms. The leaders of the colony didn't, coming from Spain. This was still something relatively new and unknown for them. But also just, you know, the sheer bad luck of it was really remarkable. Although we could also see it perhaps as good luck for the local Native American population who got a respite from Spanish colonization for another few decades. Mm.
So what are the lessons for us today? As you said, we are facing climate change and worried about what to do, what we can do, and what awaits us. So when we look back at these unexpected fortunes that the early colonists had here in North America, what are the takeaways?
So I'll back up by saying what interested me in this history was that I wanted to find some experience of the past that might speak to present-day global warming. And there are important differences between the Little Ice Age and global warming in terms of the climate. The Little Ice Age is really characterized more by these occasional extreme decades and rather than by a long-term change. And the changes that people experienced in the Little Ice Age were still small compared to the ones we experience with global warming today. However, I could get a better sense of what it was like to enter into a very different and unknown climate. And really unknowable climate, by looking at these expeditions to North America. And I think the major lesson that I drew from this, at least for me, is how hard it is to really understand a new and unknown climate and a changing climate. It's not just that you have to know sort of the big patterns of geography and climatology. That's not really enough. What we need is also to know what that means for the weather that we really experience and the ways that it affects our lives and our activities. And that simply takes time. It's just difficult to understand those shifting patterns and their implications for our lives. And I think we're going to find that with global warming in the 21st century.
So do we have enough time to learn those lessons?
Well, I mean, there are going to be impacts, certainly. It's simply unavoidable at this point. However, really the most important thing we can do is simply limit the degree of change and therefore the degree of risk that we face. I think the greatest lesson here always is that the best option, the most affordable option, is not to wait and see what happens and then try to react, but to engage in mitigation to try to bring down our carbon emissions now as fast as possible.
We've been speaking with Sam White. He's an associate professor of environmental history at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of A Cold Welcome, The Little Ice Age and Europe's Encounter with North America. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for speaking with me.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
Now, of course, things have warmed up considerably since the Little Ice Age, but there's still a fair amount of ice out there. And when we come back after a short break on our show, we're going to speak with a Norwegian researcher who tagged an Arctic fox. A fox that somehow walked across that ice in 2019 from the coast of Norway to Newfoundland in Canada. We'll be right back with more Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Norwegians have long had a reputation for being fearless explorers. Most of us by now know that Columbus was not the first European to discover America. We're pretty sure from Norse sagas, from Norse archaeological evidence on Newfoundland, out on the edge of Canada. We're pretty sure now that nearly 500 years before Columbus, Norwegian voyagers, including Erik the Red and his son Leif Erikson, most likely navigated all the way from Scandinavia to Iceland to Greenland to part of what is now Canada, which they called Vinland. It was an epic journey in long, open boats across often stormy seas. But at least the Vikings had boats to do that with. A couple of years ago, another Norwegian completed that same journey on foot. She left the coast of Norway without support or supplies. Traveling 2,175 miles in about 76 days from Norway, cutting across Greenland, ending in Canada. Well, she traveled across solid ice for much of the journey, averaging about 28 miles a day. That's a rate that actually blew the mind of researchers following her journey, following it with a GPS device attached to her. Okay, that gives it away probably. The Norwegian athlete here was Norwegian and female, but was not a representative of the species Homo sapiens. We're talking about an Arctic fox. But the speed and the distance of this journey, it was just shocking even to the experts. Erik Schultzke of our team spoke with the researcher who put the radio collar on the furry four-footed traveler. Her name, the name of the researcher that is Eva Fugli, and she's a research biologist at the Norwegian Polar Institute.
Welcome to Constant Wonder, Eva Fugli.
Oh, thank you so much.
Are you proud to be a Norwegian now?
Well, I have to say yes.
Tell us a little bit about this little fox. Let's start with Arctic foxes in general, and then we'll talk about the one that you followed. What do we know about these little guys?
Well, Arctic foxes are really, really animals that are very much adapted to live in places where it's cold, like in the Arctic. And they live there together with the polar bears, and they are distributed all over Arctic. So we used to say that they are the most kind of normal species or animal in the Arctic, because they are spread all over.
So do they live on the land masses? Do they live in the land masses in the Arctic Circle, or do they actually live out on the ice as well?
Well, they reproduce on the land masses, mm-hmm. which means that they live on the Arctic continents, but also on Arctic islands as Svalbard. So they reproduce when they get their pups. That is always on land. They are very, very small when they are born. They grow very fast, and then they have to go out and find out their own way of living. And then they are more nomadic, kind of saying.
They're solitary, right? They don't move in packs. They're solitary creatures.
That's true. They don't live in big family groups or anything. It's a mother and a father that keep a den and a territory around that den that is big enough so that they can have food to eat. And they defend that territory or that den during summer when they have their pups.
So the mother and the father both participate in raising the pups?
Yes, they do. They do. Okay. So when the mom gave birth to the pups, she stays inside the den because she has to give milk to the pups, and then the father comes with food for the mother so that she can eat and produce the milk. So he's out hunting birds or whatever he can find, and then he bring it back to her so that she can feed.
Tell me about this little fox that you put this satellite collar on. What time of year was it that you did this?
Well, this was done in July, late July 2017. And she was captured with a cage trap, kind of, that we use for capturing Arctic foxes. And then we put on a satellite tag on her. We weighted her, and we saw that she was a female and all that. And then we put a satellite tag on, and then we released her. And then for a while, she stayed in that area for until approximately March, 1st of March, 2018. And then she met the sea ice, I mean, the pack ice that is covering, go all the way to the North Pole. So there it was actually the first time she met the sea ice. And of course, we can ask, why did she walk on that sea ice and why did she continue walking? And
then I only had to guess, because we know that polar bears are living on the east coast of Svalbard because they are really dependent on sea ice. And polar bears hunt seals. And the Arctic fox, it's known that Arctic foxes are following the polar bears, and they eat the remains of the seal carcasses when the polar bear has taken off all the fat, yeah, the blubber. Because it's a lot of muscles and the proteins back on that carcass when the polar bear are finished. And then the fox, you know, they are carnivores, and they are these, they go for carcasses, and they can feed on carcasses left by polar bears.
And I remember reading about this, that you, that they can smell like up to 40 kilometers, I think you said, that they could smell.
Yeah, yeah. They can, because that has been it is another study from Canada that has also studied Arctic foxes, and then they could actually show or indicate that foxes could really change the way of moving, and then go right to a distinct place on the sea ice, and then they guess, or it indicates that it must be something to eat on that spot, that, on the sea ice.
That's astounding. Let me just repeat that, just so that, I mean, this is a fox who not only traveled 2,000 miles in 76 days, but this is a species that apparently can smell food 40 kilometers away.
Absolutely, absolutely, they can.
And that has implications here, because it means if they're following these polar bears and the carcasses of the seals, then they would, she would be able to move across the ice behind the polar bears and know where she was going following them.
Well, she will definitely, if she can could smell and then really have an indication of, there's some food out there, and then she just headed out and walked, and then she met or found a carcass or something like that. She could feed on that, and then she could actually smell another carcass maybe. Or, you know, we have also, if you look at the animation of her travel, the thing I have to say also is that these satellite tags had, it made us follow her footsteps, kind of, and that makes it so fantastic and interesting for us as scientists.
What do you mean, follow her footsteps? Explain what you mean by that.
Because we had, before we used satellite tags on Arctic foxes, there were quite many observations of foot or tracks from Arctic foxes close to the North Pole. There were remains of ear-tagged foxes that was tagged in maybe Canada, and it was found out in Greenland, for instance, things like that. And then you could have a guess about, it's an inline distance between where it was trapped and where it was found.
Right.
But now we can actually follow her track. We can see, because we get data every day and the position every day from that fox.
Are you telling me that you literally went out on the ice and found her tracks?
No, but the satellite.
Signal
and the position.
Yes, yes. See, so you knew what her path was. I mean, and there's a map. I've seen the map of her journey, and it's very precise.
Yeah. It is, and it's very funny as well, because we could not only follow her tracks or footsteps, we could also see her speed.
Mm-hmm.
We could see when she, and that was what I was going to say. She had actually a two-day stopover up in the sea ice, and that was in early April.
Oh, that was probably with food then.
Maybe, because I learned them, because I was thinking the polar, the pack ice, it must be just ice and snow and nothing to eat. But then I talk to my colleagues that work with the sea ice, and they say, no, Eva, it's a dynamic area, and you can have these openings in the sea ice, which they called as ice leads, that can open and close.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so rich. It's a rich, really, really high biodiversity up there. It's seals, it's whales, it's polar bears, there are seabirds. So it could be a potential feeding area also for – so we have to guess why did she stop.
Yeah. This shocked everyone, but it's not that she was necessarily an unusual fox. It was that we just didn't know that they did this. They probably do it more often than we think, right?
Yeah, that's true. We know that foxes can really walk for a very, very long distance, because we have done During the certain polar Arctic, there are many researchers and scientists working with Arctic foxes. So we have studied them, their genetics, and we see that Arctic fox population around in the Arctic seems to be related. We see that it's not a very structured population. It means that Arctic foxes are actually traveling over from time to time. It's difficult to say exactly how often they do it, but the Arctic fox population in Svalbard or Spitsbergen that I work with, we have actually put on tags on 54 Arctic foxes so far since 2012. So this is an ongoing larger project. But she was the only one that walked that far and actually left Spitsbergen.
Right. So let's talk about what happened there, because we know that the collar at that point somewhere in Canada, it stopped working, right?
Yeah. In February this year, that collar stopped working because the battery ran out.
Oh, so there's no indication necessarily that anything happened to her. It's just the battery ran out its natural life.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's true.
And so in theory, if she's okay, if she stayed there, could she have found a mate over there among the other Arctic fox populations?
Absolutely. She can.
So there's no genetic difference between the different foxes there?
No. It's not. Mm-hmm. They are Arctic foxes, mm-hmm. The same species. So she could reproduce mm-hmm. with a male that we found in that right. place. So that is possible. So let's hope for that.
Yeah, we can assume, because we don't have any reason to believe that the failure of the collar meant something bad for her. So we can assume that she's having a good outcome over there in Canada.
Absolutely.
Like so many immigrants to Canada, she's doing fine. That's what we'll assume, right?
Yeah, I hope so. I was thinking the same, actually. So I really crossed my fingers for that she was welcomed and she has reproduced. And right now, are a mother to two pups.
Erik Schultzke speaking with Eva Fugli. Fugli is a research biologist at the Norwegian Polar Institute. Now, just imagine you find yourself caught up in a new little ice age and you're struggling to grow veggies in your area. You might want to take a lesson or two from the folks up north above the Arctic Circle in Canada. Some people there having built a system of greenhouses. They produce bumper crops in places where you just wouldn't expect it at all. To learn more, I had a chance to speak with Ray Solotkey, executive director of the Inuvik Community Greenhouse. That's a greenhouse that lies along the northern edge of Canada's mainland, way up there. Here's a highlight from our conversation. Solotkey's job, as she tells us, is to help with food security in a cluster of far northern communities, and her greenhouse is not even the furthest north of the entire group.
The reason my job was created was actually to focus on food security in the Beaufort Delta. And the Beaufort Delta isn't just Inuvik, but it's the 10,000 people that live in the Northwest Territories above the Arctic Circle. So there are seven other communities. And I actually really hate it when I have to tell people this, but we are actually no longer the most northern greenhouse anymore, because we build greenhouses up in Sax Harbor and Ulahuktuk, which are on those big, huge islands you see on the maps of Canada that are kind of those blurry bits at the top. So there's actually greenhouses much farther north than us. They don't get a lot of days above 0 degrees, but they still are growing food. And so that's my job, is to actually help those communities with food security and also food sovereignty, which is where the jalapenos and the salsa come in. Because food security is having enough calories to feed your family, but food sovereignty is being able to eat those tacos in the middle of the winter if you want to and have access to that food whenever you want to. So that's kind of a double-edged sword of food in the north.
So food sovereignty, you say, is where somebody else isn't picking your diet for you, you get to pick and choose what you kind of like if you can get your hands on it.
Exactly. So being in a community where people say, oh, well, you eat traditional foods. Well, what if you don't want to? What if tomorrow I want to eat mac and cheese? Then I should be allowed to eat mac and cheese just like somebody in the South can. So that's what food sovereignty is all about. Not that I'm a fan of mac and cheese, but you get my point.
Well, would you take us into this greenhouse and tell us a little bit about it? I understand it used to be a hockey arena or something like that?
Absolutely. So the greenhouse was actually created out of an old hockey arena that was built in the 1970s. It was a part of the residential school system here in the Northwest Territories. So I'm not sure if you know about that. That's a whole story for another show. But when the residential school closed in 1996, that building that was the big old arena was slated for demolition. And there were people in town that were trying to get some gardening going, but having a lot of trouble because Arctic summers are short. We have 24 hours of sunlight and we can capture a lot of light, but there's often cold days. It can snow in August. It can get really muddy and mucky and disgusting. And so it's really hard to grow. Also, we don't really have soil. We're on permafrost. Our ground is frozen. And there's not a lot of nutrients in Arctic soil because it's so cold and frozen all the time. The nutrients are all leached out. So this group of people, 22 years ago now, they found this arena being slated for demolition, and they convinced the community to let them turn it into a community greenhouse instead. We have a system, or had a system up until this year, where the plots, which we have 150 of them, are parceled out in 4-foot by 8-foot sections, and then people rent the space for the summer and grow whatever they choose. We do big plant sales to help people have bedding plants and make sure we have lots of seeds and things like that. So we hire staff to make sure that there's somebody on site who can teach you how to put those seeds in the ground if you've never done it before. And then we also have plots set aside for market gardens, and we do a veggie box subscription service. And we also donate to the food bank and local community groups as well.
Now, I want to go to what gardeners never call the nuts and bolts, because you don't use nuts and bolts when you're gardening, but just the basics of, you know, everybody who gardens knows you got to start with good soil. And you told me that you're working with permafrost. Where does the soil come from? Do you generate compost? Do you thaw some of the local soils to bring it inside? How do you start, and where's the soil from?
So the original soil came from the garbage dump here just outside. They were building out the dump, and there was soil there. So that was where the original soil came from 22 years ago, and that's what we put in all of our beds. So the beds are all raised beds. They have a layer of rocks, a layer of insulation, and then the soil on top just to keep the permafrost from being damaged. We don't own the building, so if we had to leave tomorrow, we need to pull everything out and just get out. So we can do that if we have to. Hopefully that won't come to that. But we had all this old soil, but every year gardeners have to add to their soil themselves. So we are a fully organic greenhouse. We do have a compost system that's not spectacular. But people are encouraged to add fertilizer, add lots of good nutrients to it. And actually this year, part of our success was because there's a gentleman in town who has domestic rabbits. And earlier this year, I bought a bunch of bales of rabbit poop, sawdust combinations, and we made a lot of rabbit poop tea. And so we made fertilizer to use on our plots that was organic, that added it back into the soil, and it worked wonders. So it is a struggle every year to make sure people understand you can't just take the same soil every year and you have to feed it. So we'll be feeding all of our soil in the next week.
How do the plants react to nonstop sunlight, just constant sunlight through that part of the summer?
Have you ever had a period of time where you couldn't sleep for like a week? And you like kind of feel like you're going crazy. Maybe in university we stayed up for 3 or 4 days and your eyes get really red and you feel like you can hear really strange, like you can hear the sky, like things like that. That's how the plants react. They go crazy. They don't understand what's going on. They don't sleep. They're up all the time. I swear I can hear the spinach growing and screaming as it grows. Like, it is just uncomfortable to watch these plants sometimes. It goes so fast. We put seeds in the ground and 3 weeks later they're harvestable. That's not how things should be. It should not take 3 weeks to grow a full thing of spinach. It should take about 5 weeks or so, but they just grow nonstop. And so you get a lot of weird looking vegetables. You get a lot of strange carrots. You get, you know, you have to be very careful. We have to figure out shade for them. We have to really baby them. And sometimes they have to get watered 2 and 3 times a day. They go crazy.
Well, do you focus on what we would call cool season crops? Are you doing broccoli and cabbages, or can you do, you've already said tomatoes. And so I'm guessing you probably have, I wouldn't imagine there's room for a cornfield there.
Well, we actually had some people have corn this year, but we don't usually do corn in the greenhouse because it takes up too much space. I'm kind of regretting it now, but actually we don't have a cold weather problem. We have a heat problem. We are a massive 18,000 square foot building, an old hockey arena with all polycarbonate roofing. It gets to 50 degrees Celsius in there. It's hot. It's so hot. The ventilation is terrible. It's like a big tin can. We actually have better work with hot. Everything else bolts so quickly. If you grow broccoli and you grow cilantro and you grow spinach, you have to watch it constantly to make sure it doesn't go to flower too fast. Actually, a really good indicator is we brought up an apple tree in 2016. I have a lot of strange projects. I have chickens living in my garage right now. I have mushrooms in bags. I like to do a lot of weird little things to test them. And one of the things I wanted to do was make a fully Arctic apple pie. The elementary school plot and the high school plot at the greenhouse were growing wheat. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I got some wheat and grew some apples and auctioned off an apple pie at one of our fundraisers. Somebody made $600 on a chocolate cake that I think came from a box. So I could make a lot on an Arctic apple pie that was fully made here. So I brought up this apple tree, and I put it in our greenhouse. And do you know anything about apple trees?
I do. I grow them. They're challenging.
Right. And do you have more than one apple tree?
I've got about 9.
Right. You have to, because they're just like people. They can't spontaneously have babies. I didn't know this. So I brought up one apple tree like a genius and put it in this greenhouse. And it wasn't until somebody who also had about 9 or 10 apple trees say to me, too bad you'll never get an apple off that tree. You don't have a mate. Well, fun fact, if it gets over 50 degrees Celsius for a sustained period of about a week, the DNA of an apple tree will actually break down enough that it thinks it's dying and will self-propagate. So the first year, because it got so hot for so long in that space, I had 2 dozen apples, which I raffled off and bought a second and third apple tree. So we don't have a cold problem. We have a hot problem. And we grow everything. You can grow tomatoes and peppers, spinach, kale, broccoli, cauliflower, collards, melons. We don't do a lot of those. They take too much space. Zucchini, cucumbers, radishes, garlic, onion, you name it, we can grow it.
Ray Solotkey is executive director of the Inuvik Community Greenhouse in Canada. Now, just when you thought you could escape to warmer climes, we're going to be talking up ice hockey tomorrow here on Constant Wonder. But not just the sport, actually. We're going to explore how the iconic moment back in 1980, known as the Miracle on Ice, contributed to a major shift in the way international sports competitions are covered by the media today. And maybe, no promises here, just maybe, I'll let you know just how confident I am or am not about hockey terminology. When, for example, is a stick just called a stick? A puck hasn't always been a puck, by the way. That's tomorrow here on the show. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.